Welcome to Wiki Politiki, a show designed to bring right and left front and center, to turn the funk into function, and leave the junk at the junction. At a time when so much political discourse is heat without light, Wiki Politiki shines the light of love and truth on the darkened corridors of power, and then brings leading solutionaries into conversation to light the way forward together. Your host is Steve Behrman, author, comedian, and political and spiritual uncommentator. You might know Steve as his cosmic comic alter ego, Swami Beyondananda, or as the author of a more serious book with cellular biologist Bruce Lipton, Spontaneous Evolution. If you recognize that crisis precipitates evolution, and judging by the current crises, the chances of precipitation are 100%, this show is for you. Welcome to the Evolutionary Upwising. Now, here is your host, Steve Behrman.
Well, hi there, and welcome to Wiki Politiki, Conversations for Co-Creation, where we shed light on the undarkened corridors of power and shine a light ahead of us to where evolution is leading. The purpose of Wiki Politiki is to bring left and right, front and center, to face the music and dance together, to address problems instead of defending positions. Well, with political discourse and political discord nearly synonymous these days, and with the phenomenon of fake news, where facts take a backseat to emotionally fueled beliefs, maybe it's time we look at the fact that feelings make more of a difference than facts do. Might the highly charged politics out there have something to do with the emotional terrain in here? Our guest this week, psychotherapist Carol Smaldino, thinks so. She has written a book that speaks directly to the stormy political climate. It's called The Human Climate, Facing the Divisions Inside Us and Between Us. And the book examines the role of emotions in our political landscape, both in the politicians and in the diverse populations and issues that make up this landscape. Now, I'm somebody who speaks with and listens to both sides, and what's clear to me is that for the most part, each side sees the other side's shadow, but not its own. Combine this with each side constantly receiving, embracing, and absorbing information that mostly reinforces what they already know to be true, and, well, this is the problem. I know, the other side is more that way than we are, but you decide which side the other side is, and I'm sure they're saying the same thing about us. All of which, it means I think it's time for a meta-conversation, an overview, where we become aware of and integrate our feelings so we don't have to project them onto the other, and we become more aware of what pushes our buttons and how to stay less susceptible to manipulation. Today's guest, Carol Smaldino, is a social worker psychotherapist. She was a Huffington Post contributor from 2008 to 2017. Born and raised in Brooklyn, New York, I can relate to that. She attended Brooklyn College and the Wurzweiler School of Social Work at Yeshiva University. She's also done coursework at the National Psychological Association for Psychoanalysis. Before graduate school, she worked at the Bureau of Child Welfare, Roosevelt Hospital, and Youth Project. After social work school, she spent 5 years working at a residential treatment center. She was a therapist and supervisor and student at the New Hope Guild and developed a private practice in New York City and then Port Washington, New York. She presently lives and works between Fort Collins, Colorado, and Lucca, Italy. Well, that's interesting. Welcome, Carol. Glad to have you.
Thank you.
Okay. Now, this book, The Human Climate, Facing the Divisions Inside of Us and Between Us, how did the book come about?
Well, it sounds a little mysterious, but I guess one day I was sitting over coffee and I was feeling very sad about how much I felt we knew. And I was mostly thinking about psychotherapists, but, you know, mostly how much the society at large knew, I felt, about bullying and about depression and about climate change even, and how much did not seem to be getting done about these things, how much they didn't seem to be a priority. And I was just kind of sitting in sadness. So I guess the crisis of my sadness precipitated the thought that apropos of climate, there must be an emotional climate. There must be a cultural climate that is getting in the way. There must be something that is getting in the way from people using what they and we know to make a difference for the good. And I said to myself, actually, that I find talking to myself, it can be a good idea. I'm the best audience for myself.
Yeah.
So I thought I would just kind of start looking into this. And I didn't have any fancy ideas about doing a big research project. I'm not a scholar or a researcher, but I am inquisitive and I am curious and I am observant at times. And so I thought I would kind of take a look at what I could read and what I saw in my work and what I saw in my life and start to make note of it. And I thought that if I found something that should be shared according to at least my own judgment, then I would try to share it. And I really started to look at the atmosphere in which we grow or we don't grow, in which we have assumptions and in which we can either evolve because that's a value, or we don't evolve because it's assumed that we won't.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And
Hello?
Then,
yeah.
I'm here. And then I started I'm thinking that I have the chapter on history, and I've always liked history, and I thought I knew something about it. But as I read some works that I had read before, I realized that I didn't know as much as I thought I did. And I, for one, assumed that I, or let's say America, had most of the time been on the right side of things, with the exception of Vietnam and with the exception of Iraq. But I'm even talking about the Civil War. I assumed that I knew about the early parts of America, and I really did not.
And so what was it that you found most surprising? What did you discover about America that was that opened your eyes?
Well, I suppose I saw that in general, the problems we're having today, which are obviously, I guess, part of the reason that you and I are talking, are not that new. That America in some way was really founded on the notion of exceptionalism. And it had a kind of religious fervor attached to it. I found out that Abraham Lincoln was not the best human being that ever lived, that he had moments of hypocrisy and opportunism, that and then I started to rethink the Civil War. In fact, I started to rethink the position of some of the conservatives who identify or who have in the past identified with the cause of the South and how that was a humiliating defeat. And I thought about actually some people wanting the battle hymn of the Republic to be used as the national anthem. And I thought, wow, that would be pretty humiliating to a large part of the country. And also it's very religious. So I began to think about the religious aspect of much of the talk from the beginning. In fact, I have a book that's called God's Almost Chosen Peoples, and it's about the role of religion during the Civil War. And it's absolutely fascinating because every side really thought that he, she, they were pushed into this by God. And in terms of how people thought of the death, you know, the assassination of Lincoln, I mean, they all thought it was about God's will. He was supposed to be killed because he was the Messiah. He was supposed to be killed because he was Satan. All kinds of stuff like that. And how the shadow, can I say something about the shadow?
Sure, absolutely. Yeah, we're going to be talking about it anyway, so let's jump in.
Okay, well, the shadow was something I I saw in a book by Carl Jung. I mean, I had heard of it, and I'd certainly known of it in my work, but this reading Jung sort of crystallized it for me, and it crystallized a lot of the purpose of the book for me, because the idea is that when we don't get to know our emotions, we tend to put some of them in the basement or as far away as we can. We tend to try to bury them. And what happens is we don't get to know them, so we can't tame them. And either we get emotionally congested, whereas we don't know the emotions we have and they pile up one on top of the other until we burst. But what often happens is that we either explode without any kind of preparation, or and this happens most of the time, we project these feelings onto other people and we blame them. And as a result, we dehumanize them. And once we dehumanize anybody, anybody dehumanizes anybody else, all bets are off, because there's no empathy, there's no caring, there's detachment, and very often there is a freedom to be sadistic and do all kinds of things that our conscious mind would tell us we should not be doing.
Mm-hmm. Yep. When there's an enemy, all bets are off. That's exactly right. So these tend, our inner psyche tends to create the potential for these divisions. And so how would you describe the divisions inside of us? You used that term in your work. What are the divisions inside of us?
Well, if you think that we're all made up of all kinds of feelings, and so in the best of hypotheses, we get trained and allowed to express these, and then we can tame them. So we get to know them. When we can't, and they get into the arena of the shadows, it's like there are parts of us that we don't know at all. So we don't really either we don't know about them consciously, or we don't allow themselves, ourselves to own up to them. So we're at odds with the parts of ourselves that are now unconscious, and we're at odds with the parts of ourselves that we feel too politically correct to own up to. Does that make sense?
Yeah, and so I see where you're going. So you're saying that with this political correctness being something that is imposed from outside, people are ashamed or embarrassed to express their true feelings. Is that what you're saying? And then those get stuffed?
Yeah, well, that's part of it. But if we are trained, let's say, we're, you know, trained by authority, by religion, by parents, by education, to disown certain parts of ourselves, we don't even know they exist. So it's as if we internalize that teaching, and it's kind of part of us. So we hear sort of like, it's sort of like we hallucinate, like we're hearing voices from the inside that we shouldn't even let ourselves know that we have a feeling.
Yes, and I think when these things are stuffed, as Jung said, years ago when I lived in Michigan, I knew these people, and they were very, very active peace activists. That's all that they did. They worked for peace. And yet they had a dog that actually killed other dogs. So somehow I used to think that whatever was suppressed in them because of how they believed somehow got displaced onto this poor dog who was a very dangerous critter.
Yes. And I think in terms of one of the biggest surprises I had during the writing of the book is that I wrote a lot about the dark side and the shadow. And in every chapter, I found myself thinking, wow, that's really crazy, whatever it is, you know, that I was talking about. And then I thought, whoops, I have that too. I have that same condition. It's in another form. You know, I used to joke about people killing for peace, because I know that I personally know the rage at war, and it's very hard to approach this with the complexity of different feelings and admitting that a lot of us are capable of the worst of things. And one of the things I have felt really strongly about in terms of American military torture is that I want the soldiers who are reduced to the adrenaline, the terror, the rage, the vindictiveness, the vengeance, the hysteria, and the lack of control to, I'm not saying everybody's like this, but to perform acts of torture, and I know this happened a lot in Vietnam, I want them to have an audience with the rest of us. I want us to be able to listen to how a human being can perform the worst acts, because otherwise we just keep going, us and them, us and them. And you know, we the liberals are the good guys.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yep. And I think what's happened in this country over the past 50 or 75 years since the end of World War II has been we've entered into a don't ask, don't tell policy with our government. We promise not to ask them what they're doing to keep us safe, and they promise not to tell us. And that allows us to feel more human, even as inhuman things are going on. Please don't tell me about that. Please don't tell me what you're doing to keep me safe, because then I would have to deal with it as a collaborator. And I think that's what you're talking about, is that if we're able to – whoops, I guess we're going to take a break now. We're going to be back with Carol Smaldino and talking about the human climate facing the divisions inside us and between us after this message from somebody.
Connecting you with the best of the conscious minds in the world. Om Times Radio, IOM FM. Om Times Magazine is one of the leading online content providers of positivity, wellness, and personal empowerment. A philanthropic organization, their net proceeds are funneled to support worldwide charity initiatives via Humanity Healing International. Through their commitment to creating community and providing conscious content, they aspire to uplift humanity on a global scale. Om Times, co-creating a more conscious lifestyle.
My name is Victor Furman. Some call me The Voice. I've always been fascinated with human nature, spirituality, science, and the crossroads at which they meet. Join me Wednesdays at 8 p.m. Eastern on Om Times Radio, and we'll explore these topics and so much more on Destination Unlimited.
911, what is your emergency?
My kid shot himself.
All right, where's the wound?
911, what's your emergency?
Please help. My son shot his brother.
911, what's your emergency?
Okay. 911, please state your emergency.
Every day, 8 kids and teens are unintentionally killed or injured by loaded and unlocked guns.
It wasn't locked.
Learn how to make your home safer at endfamilyfire.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council and End Family Fire.
Okay, this is Steve Behrman. We're back with our guest, Carol Smaldino, talking about the inside climate of our emotions, and then the outside climate of how it plays out in our political system. So we were talking about how the shadow, and then how these projections end up causing havoc inside our political system, inside our social networks, and so on. Say more about how that happens. How do these internal conflicts and repressions and avoidance of the shadow end up impacting our political discourse out there in the world?
Well, I guess one of the things I can say about this is just to talk about, let's say, liberals and conservatives. Just to make a couple of general notes, I think that liberals on the whole have felt more innocent, have felt more empathic, and have been more open to change. whereas we have had the tendency to disown aggression. So that sometimes, let's say, we have protested, I'll speak for myself, the war in Vietnam. And when I look back on this, I see that I was pretty mean about the people who went to that war. And some of them went because they were patriotic, and some of them went because they were poor, and some of them went because John F. Kennedy said, ask not what your country can do for you, but what you can do for your country. So, and I loved him. So I feel that we were not in touch with being mean, because we were, in our minds, we were mean to mean people. And I think we didn't hold ourselves accountable. Whereas, let's say conservatives, and I'm going to say Trump people, and it could be a vast generalization, but I think it's warranted in many cases, that a lot of the people who support Trump are not in touch with their tenderness. They make fun of liberals and anybody who is too tender or sensitive, and they call them snowflakes. So the conservative, let's say the Trump person, who really is inside a deeply, probably as fragile person as any of us, is disowning that and calling the pot calling the kettle black. Yes, is calling names to the other side. So there's not a time to say, let's look at our stories and see how they may overlap and how much we may have in common.
Mm-hmm. Now, it's been said, and I know because I've said it, that the liberals are tend to represent more of the yin feminine side, the conservatives more of the yang masculine side, growth versus protection, and so on. And of course, when you have these things at war with each other, we're actually not able to use 50% of the resource that we have. So first of all, do you find that analogy holds water? And then number two, what are some of the ways that we can actually create enough of a conversation so that people can actually listen to one another?
Yes, I mean, I definitely think it holds water. And the social psychologist, who's a bit on the conservative side, his name is Jonathan Haidt, he really suggests that we all take a step back, or three steps back, he says, and really let ourselves value the other side. Because as we, let's say, liberals, want to change, there are ways that we need to conserve things. There are ways that we need to value order and structure. And as such, to the other side, too, one of the ideas I have, and I want to patent it, but it's not patented, so anybody can take it, but I'd like to be part of it. This idea for a show called How I Got Here, which would sort of insist on not discussing ideas per se, but really be a question of having a person tell the story or the stories of how he, she got to where he votes a certain way and thinks a certain way. Because I'm pretty sure that once we get to listen to the stories of another person, we're going to feel differently. We always do. That's why we go to the movies.
That's exactly right. It rehumanizes. Oh, about 10 years ago, my wife Trudy and I were buying a car, and we had to talk to the financial officer there when we were doing the working out the details. And he asked what I did, and I said, I do comedy, and I just finished writing a book called Spontaneous Evolution. He said, oh, he says, well, I've taken the Lord Jesus as my savior. I don't believe in evolution. Okay. So the next day, however, we had to spend a lot of time with this guy as we're waiting for our car to be delivered. And so I asked him to tell his story. And it turns out he was a Vietnam veteran with very, very severely traumatized, and he became an alcoholic, and his life was literally in the gutter. And at one point, he saw the hand of Jesus ready to lift him up, and that's what lifted him out of this despair. And we listened to him, and by the end of that time, he was crying, and he hugged us, and he said, "This is the first time anybody has ever heard me."
That's
so
beautiful.
I can testify to simply giving people the space to talk about how they got where they are, and you could tell his heart was in the right place, that he truly found salvation for himself, and he bought the entire package, which is, understandable that one might do that. However, he rehumanized us as well, and he said, "I would love to come hear the Swami perform," and so on. So it was a healing all around. So I could definitely affirm that what you said is true, is that when you create a setting where that's possible. So you see like a TV show. Is that what you're talking about? A TV show where the sides hear one another?
You can hear me, right?
I can hear you now, but not for the – there was some dead air on the radio, which is –
Sorry. Okay. What was I going to say? There was a movie about a year ago called Best of Enemies, and it was with Sam Rockwell, and I forget the actress's name, and it was about the head of a Ku Klux Klan in the South, and it was about – he played that role, and – it was about him and an African-American woman basically breaking down differences and coming together, largely because he stopped hating her. He felt that he was the head of a clan, so that meant he would hate black people. Well, if he didn't hate a black person, how could he go on and do what he was doing? That was kind of his own dialogue within himself. But it was a beautiful example of what we're talking about, because once something happens and people let down their guard, they can shift. Now, of course, if a person is very, very fragile or brittle or traumatized or in a cult of some sort, that may be impossible. So not everybody is going to do that, but if a good portion of the people begin, it can be contagious. Because, I mean, as much as hate and division can be exciting, like a sporting match, it's also exciting to cooperate. It's exciting to love another person.
You know, and that brings us to this other issue about the media. It seems like so many of these of the mutual hatred is not even hatred of real people. It's hatred of stereotypes and straw men. You know, when I see a bumper sticker, "I hate liberals," I just wonder if that individual has ever spoken to one, or it's simply a caricaturized projection. Which, of course, the people in the South and conservatives, they've had that for years. You know, the whole redneck thing has been thrust upon them, and there's all kinds of stereotypes as well. How do you see the mainstream media playing into either the exacerbation of these interests, or, in a better case scenario, helping to heal them?
Well, I don't see a lot of healing going on, I have to say, although there are programs from time to time that are in that category. I think, unfortunately, conflict and hatred probably pays the bills for a lot of people that keep people watching. You know, they keep people watching. It's important, I think, to know that psychology is at play. Somebody is pulling strings, and somebody is gaining from keeping us divided. Because we can't think together, we can't cooperate, we can't do what's best for our country, we can't pick the best person, we can't evaluate together what will be good for all of us and the future of the planet. And we're manipulated in general. I think this has gone on for a long time into thinking that it's one way or the other. Let's say I've had the conversation, and you know, you've mentioned that I worked in the welfare department, that welfare is ridiculous. It's bad. It's an entitlement. It keeps people lazy. That's just simply not true. It has been run badly. And I'm sure if you got some conservative people to work on the usefulness and the efficacy of the program, it would be good. But I want to know who are the psychologists who were smart enough, and it's not me. I'm not one of them. I can be a good thinker, I can be intuitive, and I can be empathic, but I'm not in the mindset of the people who work at ad companies and who work for those campaigns and who work for political campaigns. But there are some people who are very quiet, who are very quiet, and they're psychologists, and they know what's going on, and they know what is being done to manipulate us into fighting. And if some of them would come forward and help us know how we're being manipulated and how we can get out of it, I think that would help. Because I keep thinking that nobody likes to be played a fool, and that we are being played. We're all being played.
You know, that's exactly true. On my tour this past fall, I spoke with quite a few conservatives, mostly young conservative men in their 30s. And when I said to them that divide and conquer is the oldest political racket in history, and that we have been intentionally divided into the red tribe Republicans and blue tribe Democrats who are at odds with one another, we've been purposely divided so that we don't actually unite around the virtues and values that we have in common, the response that I got was, yeah, that's right. So I think that people are ready to understand that. Even if they're on one side or another, they're ready to understand that this is a tried and true, or actually tried and false, way of managing people. And in fact, there was you may have seen the BBC documentary years ago called Century of Self. And one of the features, Edward Bernays, who was Freud's nephew, for the people out there that don't know the story, he was the father of what's called of modern public relations, and he wrote a book called Propaganda. And he lived to be 103, and in his long life he did many, many campaigns, including the classic campaign in the 1928 Easter Parade, which he did for American Tobacco Company, where he had women dressed as suffragettes, young women, young debutantes, light up cigarettes, and they raised them high to the sky and said, these are torches of freedom, because until then it was simply not proper for women to smoke. And so in introducing, in associating women smoking with the women's right to vote, in a very distorted way, he introduced a younger generation, and persisted on since that time, to tobacco. He also worked for the CIA later on to sell their campaign to upset the government in Guatemala. So he started about 100 years ago working during World War I. So we have 100 years of that kind of that level of manipulation going on. That is probably, as you would suggest, become more and more sophisticated. So I would love to find the psychologist working out there who can blow the whistle on what's really happening, and perhaps someone has. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I know about Bernays, and I've written, I hope I haven't written Propaganda. I've read it. I mean, it's a very disturbing book, but... and he learned. I mean, he used to take walks with his uncle and learn about the tenets of psychoanalysis, and he used them in his work. So I'm sure people are using them. But, you know, the other thing in terms of interrupting this cycle. I think for those of us who want to really try to interrupt it, we need to look at ourselves. We need to take the first move. We need to look inward. And I will say that I can relate to being a bit of a snob. Not that I consider myself an intellectual, but I was an East Coaster for years and years. And I know that we felt, or the people I can identify with, felt a kind of moral and intellectual superiority to a lot of the country. And I think that's obnoxious and that it's taken a toll and that a lot of people haven't liked it. And I think if we want to change things, we have to stop insulting people. Even if I confess that I have a really difficult time talking to an avid racist, I need to stop feeling better than.
You know, and it's not just that. I think also you mentioned this earlier in passing, and that is the emotional charge we get, all of us, the emotional charge all of us have learned to get from conflict, from mm-hmm. being on one side or the other. And a very wise friend of mine years ago said, I stopped watching the news because I noticed that I started to get off on negative things, that I felt there was something that was stimulating. You know, kind of like, you know, turning your head to look at an accident scene.
Like so a I hate think part addiction.
How's that?
It's like a hate addiction.
Yes. Yes, exactly. It is an addiction. It is an addiction. And I think we're learning much more about the kinds of addictions that people have. Addicted to watching the news. Addicted to being stimulated. You know, I've got friends who hate Donald Trump, but they can't stop watching him.
Right.
Why do you want to poke yourself in the eye, you know? Why are you doing that? So anyway, we're going to be back after this very short break. We'll be back with Carol Smaldino, and we'll talk more about the inner world and the outer world and what we can do to heal the body politic or the emotional body politic.
Your mind with Om Times Radio, IOM FM.
Ascending Hearts is no ordinary dating site, but a spiritual dating site with a purpose, to link you with your soulmate. We engineer the serendipity so you can trust that you will attune with someone that has the same matching vibration as you. Ascending Hearts, the conscious dating site for the spiritually aware. Try Ascending Hearts for free, ascendinghearts.com.
More than 24 million Americans have an autoimmune disorder, and that number continues to grow. I'm Sharon Saylor, and I'm one of those 24 million. To put that number in perspective, cancer affects about 9 million and heart disease up to 22 million. That's why I've brought together top experts and those thriving regardless of their diagnosis to bring you the latest, most up-to-date information. Join me, Sharon Saylor, Friday night, 7 p.m. Eastern, for the Autoimmune Hour on Life Interrupted Radio to find out how to live your life uninterrupted.
Are you done with the daily barrage of negativity? Ready for some positivity? Creations Magazine has been inspiring the soul for over 30 years, delivering thought-provoking and solution-driven articles, essays, and poetry that inspire you to enjoy a vibrant life. Holistic health, personal and spiritual growth, relationships, the environment, and so much more. Read us online or order a subscription, creationsmagazine.com.
Imagine being fired because of who you love. Imagine being denied medical treatment because of who you marry. Imagine being evicted because of who you are. Millions of Americans don't have to imagine this. They have to live it. Because in 31 states, it's legal to discriminate against LGBT people. Get the facts at beyondido.org. Brought to you by the Gill Foundation and the Ad Council.
This is Steve Behrman. We're back with our guest, Carol Smaldino, talking about the human climate facing the divisions inside us and between us. Now, I saw something really interesting in your press piece, or maybe it was the book itself. You said that the media is pushing vulnerability and mindfulness, and this is having a negative impact. Could you explain that?
Well, yes, I can explain that. I mean, in and of themselves, they're not particularly negative values. I just think that what happens is, I think if we're going to start facing our shadows, let's say, it's not all that pretty. And so what I think is that vulnerability per se is a little like breaking open and becoming naked. And very often it needs to proceed one toe at a time and not just by jumping in, because that's like having a breakdown in Times Square. And for those of you who don't know what Times Square is like, well, it's just not a good place.
Yeah.
It's not a good country. So I think what can happen is when people talk and over-talk consciousness and mindfulness and vulnerability, what happens is that it gets less and less authentic, and people start to repeat and rehearse, and it sounds very poetic. And I think that leads to a kind of fakery, which is not really helpful if we're going to come to terms with our own shadows or with each other, because we're really making believe.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. You know, it's sort of like, okay, I need to learn the language. And I think that's really
right.
what this political correctness has been, which it totally drives me crazy because of the inauthenticity of it, and because it, in my view, it prevents conversations. It's a conversation stopper. People just shut up, and then they get to dehumanize each other in a quiet way rather than by yelling at each other. How do you deal with that? You know, I've been on campuses recently where there were people who held quote unquote conservative views. I mean, just like even the view that, you know, there's really only two sexes, that view, and they couldn't speak. They were silenced. They did not feel comfortable speaking up in class even. And how do progressives who consider themselves much more open-minded, what's that blind side that progressives have that closes their mind in such a way that they don't even realize that they've closed their mind and essentially they've shut off free speech?
Well, I mean, it's a really good question. I think you asked before something about, let's say, the vulnerability or the weakness of what liberals can do. And I think that sometimes we hate our own judgment. We hate our own prejudice. We hate our own racism. We hate, you know, I don't know if you're familiar with the term white fragility, but Robin DiAngelo has, she's a white woman, has written about it a lot. And I think it's been talked about it a lot, that she talks about, especially progressives, being raised to feel that being racist is bad, that being racist means that you're a bad person. So if that's the case, even if you're a relatively good person or good and bad person, you're going to be loath to admit that you have racist emotions, which I think all of us do. It's just not possible not to. But we're raised, you know, let's take the liberal, we're raised to feel that we need to feel good about how we feel. We need to feel good about how we think, that we're on the right side. So even if you have two liberals together, you have this political correctness about using certain words or certain terms. And we need sort of a campaign to open ourselves up to say, look, we are as full of hate as anybody else. And we are as, if we're not as full of hate, we have the potential to hate under certain circumstances. And that, I remember when I read Carl Jung's line that said, under certain circumstances, we're all potential killers. my stomach, I had my insides feel very uncomfortable. I was very uncomfortable with his saying that even those of us who have not participated in slavery have the legacy of it on our hands and we have to work it through. I didn't really like it. And then I thought about it and I let it sink in. And I think it's hard to do. But I think if I've accomplished anything in this book, one of the things that I've gotten to is to walk my talk. And so really what happened to me, since we're talking about being more open to the other side and compassion, you know, compassion is one of the things that it has become an industry all of its own. You see on the internet, become compassionate and you'll earn more money. And I kid you not, it's like, start your day with gratitude and you'll find that you don't get sick. Well, I don't think that's the point. I think the point is get to know your darker sides and your more tender sides, and you will be organically compassionate because you won't, as Bryan Stevenson of Just Mercy and many other wonderful things he's done, he says that once you're in touch with how you're broken, how any of us are broken in so many ways, we really don't have the desire to break another person. So I think what happened to me was once I got at least more in touch than before with so many aspects of my own self that were not that pretty, I really felt a wave of compassion come over me. I just didn't feel like I was so superior to just about anybody. Now, I'm sure I'm going to have my moments where somebody who's a really big racist or makes fun of me and humiliates me or talks about immigration as if these people who are fighting for their lives have no humanity, I'm going to get ill and I'm going to want to strike back and I'm going to have to recognize that and I'm going to have to control that in some way so I don't go into the morass of the joys of hating. But yeah.
The joy of hating. That's a whole other book. I want to read that book. But something that you mentioned that I think is really important that we haven't really touched on is how we judge ourselves and how we want to push certain aspects of our own shadow, the things that we've done that we're not that proud of. How do we bring acceptance to these things? How do we bring self-forgiveness and acceptance in a way that's not cliched but actually creates transformation?
That's a good question. And I think part of this is heading towards the difficulty of honesty and the importance of authenticity, even if it's uncomfortable. Because I think that sometimes if we get uncomfortable, we just go away from the topic. In terms of being uncomfortable, I have felt, and this is on a political level, I have felt a huge pressure to love Barack Obama. And now that could sound funny to you, but I do know some of the things that I don't like about him. For one, he did not look at the Bush and Cheney torture program. He said, basically, let bygones be bygones, and everybody makes mistakes. Now, I have a big problem with that because I don't think it's okay not to hold torturers accountable. I don't think it would have been okay to say about Hitler, well, let's really not dwell on the past, because one of the things I do say, even on an emotional level, that it's not just a matter of dwelling on the past. If you don't dwell on the past enough to work it through, the past is going to dwell inside of you, and we're going to act it out, flip it out. So I just read a book called American Nuremberg, and it talked a lot about Obama's drone presence in the world and some of his secret ways of operating. And I can tell you, I felt a little bit of guilt, almost like I don't want to be reading this because it's going to make me be controversial with a lot of the people I know who are progressives and love him and love his wife and wish he could come back. And that just gets me to one more thing, which is that it's a kind of liberal nostalgia. And while liberals are usually more open to change, conservatives have a tremendous amount of nostalgia. This, like, make America great again, or Obama, even when acts of violence were committed, saying Americans are not like this. Yeah, we are. This is not looking at the past and saying it was great and let's go back there and become great again. This is saying we were not so great. So it's about saying to myself in this case, to answer your question, listen, Carol, you need to be able to have permission to have this thought, even though it's not that pretty and it's not that popular and it's not that popular even with your own kind. You know, even, and what I mean by that, just to be clear, is, you know, people who think a lot like me would have a lot of trouble with that concept. But I think what we need to say is that, and really encourage, is that this is not pretty. This is messy. Life is messy. Coming to terms with our truth and our shadow is kind of yucky, just to be technical. You know, seriously, it's not easy, and we are going to go in and out. And we need permission to do that. It's jolty and jerky, and it's not a poem. It's not a poem to be read in a class to applause. And I think, you know, I talk about the ceilings and the basements. I say that a lot of the advice we get and a lot of the things we're told to listen to takes place on the ceilings of life. And a lot of the time, we live in the basement. You know, we can act. We can walk out of a therapy session and we can intend to go into our home where our partner is and say, honey, I love you. I'm sorry. I thought about blah, 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 blah. And something happens and we go in and we say probably a word that I'm not supposed to say on the radio. We just mess it up. So we need to know that confronting our shadows is not in one fell swoop. We're going to mess up. And so half the time, we're going to have to recover. We're going to have to repair and recover. We're going to have to say we're sorry. We're going to have to let go of the shame or make a concerted effort to help each other and ourselves to let go of the shame of being imperfect, because it is not that pretty. And so once we, let's say, liberals can realize none of this is pretty and we don't have as much pressure on ourselves to be so neat and petite and good looking, I think we're going to be more compassionate with other people who are a wreck in one way or another.
You know, I think part of this displaced feelings on the conservative side, they like the outlaws. I think that, you know, Trump is kind of an outlaw. And there's something about speaking up, speaking truth in a way that's harsh and unpleasant to the people who don't really want to face what you were just talking about. They don't want to look at their own shadow. They don't want to imagine that they have a negative thought in their head. And yet, this is – we mentioned Obama. During the Obama administration, there were more Monsanto people appointed to positions of power than any other administration. And he just put a nice face on the American empire. And
right.
That seems to be what the Democrats have been doing.
Right.
They make people feel better because, you know, we're on the right side and we really believe in this. We believe in climate change, but we haven't done anything about it. We believe in all of these things, economic justice, but we haven't done anything about it. And so it's that, you said earlier, this sense of superiority that we have the right ideas. But as you, I really like the basement and the ceiling. A lot of those ideas are in the ceiling, on the ceiling. They're at lofty thoughts. They never get to the basement. And the reaction, I don't know if you saw the Ricky Gervais rundown of Hollywood at the Golden Globe Awards, but he really was totally insulting of Hollywood, particularly that kind of hypocrisy where they have all the right causes, but they fail to recognize that they're living lives that are so financially above and beyond what other people are living, that it's ridiculous. And so I really want to get back to the idea of the shame of being imperfect. I think you've nailed it, that we all, since you were children, have had this whatever it means to be perfect, whatever it means, the original sin, we're not good enough. So in the minute or so we have left, how do we release our own shame of being imperfect? How do we transform that?
Okay, I'm going to be daring and switch the question around a tad because something came to me, and the excitement is involved, you know, is when something comes to you. So something came to me that I think that Democrats who fear aggression really on some level love Donald Trump, because he is like, he has the excitement of a mafia guy. And I love Tony Soprano. I used to want to have Tony Soprano in my pocket to defend me from time to time. So one of the things I think is so crucial is that we, you know, the liberals among us know our anger. So we can be firm in who we come together on.
Very good. Very good. I like that, because it's really ultimately putting it back in our court. What a wonderful conversation, Carol Smaldino. We are talking about our political climate change and our human climate change. Steve Behrman, Wiki Politiki. We'll be back again next week.
Okay, thank you.